Papa, non, en 2024, créer un site web n'est plus une galère, c'est même devenu ultra simple, et notamment grâce à des solutions comme Squarespace. Squarespace est la plateforme tout en un pour permettre aux entrepreneurs de se démarquer et réussir en ligne, et ce, quelle que soit la taille de leur activité. Vous allez voir, tout y est. Vous pouvez vendre vos produits physiques ou services en un temps record. Vous avez des centaines de templates de sites web canon dans tous les domaines. Vous pouvez créer vos campagnes email. Vous pouvez même vendre votre propre formation en ligne. Donc, si vous voulez donner à votre business toutes les chances de se développer avec un outil à la fois performant et très simple d'utilisation, eh ben, je ne peux que vous recommander d'aller sur le site squarespace.com. En plus, à l'occasion de ce partenariat, Squarespace vous offre moins 10% sur votre première commande de site web ou de domaine avec le code Pauline. Alors, n'attendez plus et rendez-vous sur squarespace.com, code Pauline. Mes amis, bonjour, ici Pauline Agneau et je suis ravie de vous accueillir pour un nouvel épisode du podcast. Alors pour ceux qui ne me connaîtraient pas encore, ce podcast c'est un peu ma petite psychothérapie personnelle où je vais partir à la rencontre d'invités tous plus passionnants les uns que les autres, des artistes, des entrepreneurs, des scientifiques, des athlètes, je brasse large. Et mon objectif, c'est d'explorer avec vous leur parcours pour essayer d'en apprendre un maximum de choses et essayer de devenir la meilleure version de moi-même. Aujourd'hui, j'ai vraiment une interview qui est pépite. J'ai eu l'honneur d'accueillir à mon micro Gretchen Rubin. Gretchen est l'auteur de nombreux best-sellers vendus à plusieurs millions d'exemplaires dans le monde entier, parmi eux The Four Tendencies ou The Happiness Project ou encore Better Than Before. Vous l'aurez compris, Gretchen est américaine et oui, cet épisode est en anglais, mais je vous rassure tout de suite, si jamais vous n'aimez pas trop l'anglais et que vous voulez quand même écouter cet épisode, eh bien vous pouvez le faire via ma chaîne YouTube qui est disponible en tapant Pauline Agneau tout simplement, où vous pourrez avoir accès aux sous-titres de cet épisode. Gretchen est également l'autre du célèbre podcast Happier, dans lequel elle explore en profondeur le sujet du bonheur et les habitudes qui nous rendent heureux. Pourtant, rien ne la prédestine à devenir auteur, et elle a même commencé sa carrière dans la justice, figurez-vous, à la Cour suprême des États-Unis. Elle nous expliquera les débuts surprenants de sa carrière d'écrivain et comment elle a progressivement créé un écosystème autour de ses livres et de son podcast. C'est vraiment passionnant. Dans cette interview, ce que j'ai particulièrement apprécié, c'est que Gretchen partage énormément d'outils et de connaissances pratiques pour nous aider à mieux nous connaître. On a notamment évoqué son livre sur les quatre personnalités que je vous invite vraiment à découvrir, qui s'appelle The Four Tendencies, dont on parle en détail. Je vous mets le lien dans les notes de l'épisode. Et puis on a également parlé du pouvoir des habitudes, mais aussi de son prochain livre, Life in Five Senses, et bien d'autres choses encore. Vous verrez que Gretchen est une mine de connaissances, et vous n'êtes pas encore fan de son travail, et bien je suis sûre que vous le deviendrez après cette interview. Je ne vous en dis pas plus, et laisse place à ma conversation with Gretchen Rubin.
Hello, Gretchen. So nice to meet you.
Hello. I'm so happy to be talking to you.
Well, I hope this is your first French-speaking podcast.
I think that it is, yes. And I'm so happy to begin with you. This is wonderful.
So I have a premiere. Thank you so much. I thought about this interview and thought, you know, the best would be to start with your new upcoming book, Life in Five Senses. So maybe you could just tell me what the book is about, first of all, and then second, what triggered really you writing it.
You know, whenever I write about happiness and human nature, and I always use myself as the subject. I'm sort of my own test, experimental subject. And, what I realized was that I was feeling very caught up in my head, not engaged with the world. I felt like I wasn't appreciating the moment. And I wanted to have a kind of more direct contact with reality and other people and myself. And I turned to the five senses and I realized, you know, we talk about the five, Aristotelian senses or the five kindergarten senses, the most basic senses. And I just spent some time doing experiments, learning all the research and, you know, the contemporary science to try to understand these senses better. And then also to find ways in my own life to sort of bring them, you know, more into my experience so that I could spark my creativity, give myself more calm, connect better with other people. And I mean, this was the most delightful project ever. It was so fun. And really the way I got the idea for it is I went to the eye doctor. I'm very nearsighted. So I can't see at all without glasses. And the doctor just kind of as an offhand remark was like, oh, well, you know, someone who's as nearsighted as you is at high risk for to have their retina detached. And that can, you know, that can cost you your vision. So like, we need to monitor that. And I was like, wait, I have never heard of this before. Like, this is news to me. What are you talking about? And just this little reminder of how vulnerable we are made me realize, like, of course I could be happy if I lost the use of one or more of my senses, but I'm like, but I'm not even appreciating them right now when I have them. And it just shocked me into a realization that I needed to focus in on this part of my life.
Wow. And when was this, this epiphany basically?
This was a couple of years ago. And so I've been thinking about it for a long time and doing different experiments, many of which don't make it into the book, because I've never written a book where more stuff got cut out. I got a lot on the cutting room floor. So now I'm just thinking, so much pleasure in the five senses.
Great. And so I really wanted to ask, the book is not out yet at the moment we're speaking, but it can be pre-ordered, by the way.
Yes.
But so I was wondering, what is a major key finding you really want the people that will read the book to take away?
I really want people to realize, like, the five senses is something that's right there with us all the time. And, you know, you may think, well, the world is just the world. It's this objective truth, but it's really not. Each of us lives in a very unique world that our brain and our body is like feeding to us. And by focusing in on it, we can really amplify the things that we love. And we can also bring amplify the things that maybe we neglect. So take me, I'm a person who just is not very attuned to sound. Like, I never really listened to music. I thought of myself as someone who like didn't really like music. But then when I thought about it, I realized, like, actually, I did have my own way of loving music. And I did find ways to tune into the pleasures of sound. Same thing, like, I'm not really very interested in taste, which of course is a very popular sense. Many people love the sense of taste. And so for me, it was like, okay, well, how do I bring that more into my life and get pleasure from it? And then also, how do I learn more about the senses, like the sense of smell that already gave me great delight, but I didn't really know very much about. I really just think that for all of us, this is something that, you know, it's right. We have it. It's part of our existence. But so often we just don't pay attention to it.
Yeah, it's funny, circling back to, I mean, your whole pursuit of happiness and explaining, you know, what happiness is and how we can try to approach it. It seems that it really is a way to be very grounded, to focus on our senses and to be, you know, focused on ourselves and the small things in a way,
yes,
I guess.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think throughout all my work, I'm very interested, like you said, the small things, the ordinary day, what a regular person can do starting tomorrow without spending a lot of time, energy, or money. You know, I love people's like big radical projects, but, you know, that's not my way. And also just this idea that, you know, how can we shape just the practice of everyday life to be happier, healthier, more productive, and more creative? That's really, and understanding how people are like each other and different from each other. Because I think one thing we assume is that everybody will respond the same way. Everybody can use a to-do list. Everybody should get up early and do the first thing in the morning. Everybody needs a deadline. It's like, no, they don't. And it's like, everybody loves music. No, they don't. So that's definitely a theme. It is funny because I started out writing the Happiness Project. So I wrote about sort of generally about happiness. But then I wrote a book about habits because habits are important to happiness. And now I'm writing a book about the five senses because the five senses are important to happiness. And I wrote a book about happier at home because home is very important to happiness. So yeah, I'm sort of drilling deeper and deeper into the into happiness with every book.
I love it. And maybe you know this, but this audience is what I would call a very smart audience. So basically people that are very educated, very into business, usually very driven people. So I would suppose exactly the people that are usually unhappy or worse believe that being happy is sometimes to be mediocre. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever heard this preconceived idea, but I would love for you to elaborate on this, because I think I've heard so many times people that are very smart and very engaged in their work, for instance, saying, but I mean, trying to be happy is really just like not being very ambitious, basically. And so I would love for you to elaborate on this idea.
Absolutely. I hear that all the time. And I remember one of my favorite bosses once said to me, an ambitious person can't be happy. And I remember thinking, I don't buy that, you know, and I think that in fact, it is not true, because I think we can accept ourselves and expect more from ourselves. And by accepting ourselves, we can think about what's true for us. We can think about how we set our lives up to reflect our own temperament, nature, and values. We can think about building in the things that we know are going to make us happier, like fostering relationships, which, you know, ancient philosophers and contemporary scientists agree is a key to happiness, maybe the key to happiness, if you were going to pick just one thing. And yet at the same time, we can strive for that atmosphere of growth. We can try to learn more or advance or teach or fix or improve or study. And that's also an important element of happiness, is this feeling of forward motion. So I think it's a false choice to think that you can either be successful or you can be happy. I think that you can be happy and yet retain, you know, that desire to move forward and to grow. But you have to think about it, because as I'm sure your audience knows, it can be very easy to do things that are very contrary to happiness. Like, I'm going to try to train myself to get by with 4 hours of sleep a night, so that I have time to do all my work emails and watch television, and, you know, because I need my me time. It's like, okay, no, you know, 4 hours of sleep is not going to be enough for most people. So that's, you sort of can't get by with that. Or you might think, well, I don't have time for relationships now. I just have to focus on my work. And if there's not a transactional element, then I just don't have time for it. But we know in the long run, that doesn't make people happy. In fact, one thing that research shows is that when you ask people, are you happy at work? Two factors are very important. One is, do you have a friend at work? Meaning, do you have somebody who you can trust, you know, someone you could tell an important secret to? So a real friend, not just a casual acquaintance. And then also, do you feel like your direct boss, not your distant boss, but your direct boss, cares about you and wants to help you achieve your aims for yourself? Does that person really like know you and want to help you achieve your aims? And so these are obviously very important for happiness, but they're also going to contribute to somebody doing well at work. You know, they don't point in different directions. They're really complementary.
Yeah, that's super interesting to see that actually both ideas actually grow on each other and yes. help each other. Mm-hmm. Yes. And very counterintuitive, I would say.
Well, I think sometimes people do assume, like, if I want to succeed, I just have to put up with like a lot of unhappy years. But, you know, there's something called the arrival fallacy. And this is the idea, like, I'll be happy when I start my own business. I'll be happy when I get that promotion. I'll be happy when I get that raise. I'll be happy when I switch careers. And what the research shows is that often arriving at that destination doesn't bring us kind of this explosion of happiness that we might have thought, partly because you're sort of, by the time something like that happens, you're kind of used to it and it's sort of incorporated into your worldview. And also, a lot of times things bring their own issues. Like, yeah, you get that promotion, but now you've got a whole new set of responsibilities, and lots of new headaches. So unless you're like winning an award where somebody just hands you a trophy and you walk out, oftentimes, you know, when we arrive somewhere, we have new responsibilities, new duties, new worries, I think an important thing for happiness is to enjoy the process. Can you be happy now? Can you be happy while things are unfolding?
Would you say then that happiness is less of a state actually than, I guess, a mindset?
Yes, though maybe instead of mindset, I would say sort of a process, because for me, and this may just be my approach, because certainly a lot of people think about mindset and perspective a lot, but I find it very hard to work directly in my mind for things like, I want to be more optimistic. I mean, I feel like I can't really grasp that. And I start to get very frustrated when I try to think about my sort of internal process. What I focus is on our conscious actions, because a lot of times you can change your thoughts by the way you act. And yet our actions are so much easier to measure, to control, to shape. And so I'm always thinking like, well, how can I go from the outside in? So I would say, instead of thinking about it as a mindset, for me, it's more helpful to think about it as a process. So, okay, Pauline, if you do this, if you do that, is it likely to make you happier over the course of the next weeks, the next months, the next years? And usually people, they have a pretty good sense. They're like, if I got 7 hours of sleep a night, do I think that would make me happier over the course of months and years? And they think, you know what? Probably that would make me happier. I probably would feel more energetic. I probably would stop getting sick as much. And so that's easier to for me to think about, like, what are those conscious actions that I can take? And then just, is it moving me in the right direction? Is the process moving in the right direction? Rather than focusing on my mindset, which to me can feel just frustrating.
Yeah, and probably a little theoretical.
I don't even talk, a lot of people who study happiness and human nature focus a lot on kind of brain chemistry. And I'm like, if I can't measure it myself, I'm not that interested in it. Serotonin levels, I don't know. But do I know if I've exercised every single day since January 1? I can measure that. I can do a Don't Break the Chain journal and keep track of that and measure that and see what the consequence is. Rather than, something like, I want to enjoy the moment. It's like, I'm like, I can't just enjoy the moment. But if I'm like, I really want to stop and smell all the smells in my everyday life, that I can do.
Super interesting. So do you actually keep up or advise to people that follow you to keep up like a happiness journal where they write down basically what they enjoy and so they can go back to it?
Okay, well, this gets into my four tendencies framework. Can we take a second and talk about the four tendencies?
Okay. And I did the test, by the way, so we'll talk about that too.
Ooh, I want to find out what you are. Okay, so the reason why your question brings up the four tendencies is because what I have found is there's no one-size-fits-all solution for happiness. There's no tool or almost no tool that works for everybody. And so one of the questions is, okay, you're like, okay, well, then how do I know what tools are going to work for me?
Yeah.
Or how can I understand why this tool that works so well for me isn't working well for my coworker or my sweetheart or my kid or my friend? Like, why can't you just do what I do? Or why can't I do what you do? You know, we often get in these patterns of like, who's right, who's wrong. So this is a framework that really explains a lot of patterns you see in the kinds of tools that tend to work well for people. Okay, so if somebody wants to take a quiz, they can go onto my site. They can go to quiz.gretchenrubin.com and take a free quick quiz. Like 3 million people have taken the quiz. And you get an answer and a little report.
Very well done, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So there's that. But really, this framework is very obvious. I will just give a brief description and most people will be able to know what they are. People in their lives are television characters. It's pretty blatant once you know what to look for. Surprisingly blatant. I'm kind of astonished that no one else figured this out before me because once you know about it, it seems really obvious. Anyway, so this framework divides people into upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. And what it looks at is how you respond to expectations, which sounds dry, but ends up being very juicy. So we all face two kinds of expectations, outer expectations, like you have a work deadline, or inner expectations, like you want to get back into meditation, or you want to keep a New Year's resolution. So depending on whether you meet or resist outer and inner expectations, that's what makes you an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, a rebel. So an upholder readily meets outer and inner expectations. So they meet the work deadline, they keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what other people expect from them, but their expectations for themselves are just as important. So their motto is, discipline is my freedom. Then there are questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do something if they think it makes sense. So they're making everything an inner expectation. They don't care about outer expectations, but if an expectation makes sense to them, it will become an inner expectation and they will do it. They resist anything arbitrary, inefficient, unjustified. They tend to love to customize and to research. So their motto is, I'll comply if you convince me why. Then there are obligers. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. So these are people who say things like, I don't understand why I can keep my promises to other people, but I can't keep my promises to myself. Because what they need is outer accountability, even for an inner expectation. So if a person wants to read more, they need to join a book group. Or if they need to exercise, they need to take a class or work out with a trainer or work out with a friend who'll be annoyed if they don't show up or raise money for a charity, anything to create outer accountability. They are the rock of the world. They are the ones who come through for others because they meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet their expectations for themselves. So their motto is, you can count on me. And I'm counting on you to count on me. And then finally, Rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. They can do anything they want to do. But if you ask or tell them to do something, they are very likely to resist. And typically, they don't tell themselves what to do. Like, they don't sign up for a 10 a.m. woodworking class on Saturdays because they think, well, I don't know what I'm going to want to do on Saturday. And just the idea that someone's expecting me to show up is going to annoy me. So their motto is, you can't make me, and neither can I. So those are the four.
I love it.
Okay. So Pauline, what is your tendency?
To tell you the truth, Gretchen, I was hoping I would be an upholder because, you know, it feels like it's like very balanced and that basically you know when you need to say no, when you don't, etc. But actually, I discovered now that you're explaining it, it seems obvious that I'm actually an obliger, which is, by the way, if I read correctly, the report is the largest group. So I'm one of...
It is the biggest group. It's the biggest group for both men and women. And actually, like, given like your role, it's kind of good that you're an obliger because you probably understand the experience and perspective of, you know, the biggest number of people in your audience, because that is obliger. The smallest one, just for the biggest and the smallest one, and I don't think this comes as a surprise to people probably, is rebel. That is the smallest one. But what was surprising to me was that my tendency, which is the upholder tendency, is only slightly larger. Those are sort of the two extreme types. But, you know, there is no one best tendency, though. I think sometimes people will say, oh, I wish I was this one, or I wish I weren't this one. But they all have strengths and weaknesses. They all include people who are wildly successful and then also people who struggle. And what you see is the people who are the happiest, the most successful, the healthiest, the most creative, are the people who have really figured out how to work with their tendency, to get the strengths of it and to, you know, offset the limitations of it so they can achieve their aims for themselves. So it's not that one is better than another, but that each of us needs to figure out, like, I'm an upholder, and one of the things you see about upholders is they're very rigid. It's very hard. They get an idea in their head. It's very hard for them. Or they think they have to do something. It's hard for them to remember, like, well, do I have to do it? And so once I realize the weaknesses of my tendencies, I've been much better able to kind of counterbalance them. And I think that's true for all the tendencies.
I guess. And so in my respect, for instance, being an obliger would probably mean I need to really have drives like that are very clear to me to be able to go through discipline, like, for instance, to have a coach, I would suppose, because his watching me would be something important for me to be more, you know, into exercise, etc. So I guess you're trying to use your own tendency basically to help yourself in a very aware way.
Exactly. Because often, you know, it's like, okay, if you want, let's just say exercise more, let's say you want to exercise regularly. Well, there's many, many, many tools that a person could do. And so are you just going to try things haphazardly or like follow a random person's advice? If you know you're an obliger, you can think, well, these are the kinds of things that tend to work for obligers. Maybe they've thought of things you haven't thought about. Like for many obligers, thinking about their future self gives them a kind of I was very surprised to realize this, but for many obligers, that's a kind of outer accountability. Their future self is a form of accountability, which is very imaginative if you think about it. For some obligers, this doesn't work, but for some it does. And so, but maybe that's never occurred to you before. But once you know that's a tool, if you're like, oh, well, some obligers find this useful, maybe I could try this in my own head, you could find a tool that you'd never considered before because you're looking kind of, well, what is the obliger toolbox? But then, you know, a lot of times we're always trying to get each other to do what we want them to do, right? That's the great challenge of adult life, is how to get yourself to do what you want to do and how to get other people to do what you want them to do. So a lot of times people might give each other bad advice. Like, let's say I'm a rebel. I might say, hey Pauline, you don't need a deadline. You don't need accountability. You don't want somebody looking over your shoulder. You just get clear on what you want. If you want to get in shape, like, once you decide that's what you want, you'll do it, right? This is kind of this mindset talk. And for a rebel, that's incredibly valuable. What is my identity? I'm an athlete. What do I want? I want freedom and energy and fitness and a sense of choice. And, you know, I want to do something a little rebellious. Like, I'm going to work out in the middle of my workday when I'm supposed to be sitting in front of my screen. I'm going to be outside going for a run. These are the way a rebel would do it. That's not a good advice for an obliger, not because it's not perfectly valid advice that someone might very much benefit from, but it tends not to work for obligers because they respond to outer accountability, whereas rebels It's counterproductive. Rebels don't like the feeling of somebody looking over their shoulder. They don't want somebody checking in on them. And so you can see that this, it's the same tool could work really well for one person and not work at all for someone else. And again, not because of anything related to the tool. It's a perfectly good tool. It's just that some people find it useful and some people do not. Now, questioners love research. And for them, often, like, they're the people that are always saying, like, get clear on your why, like, understand the reasons, customize things. That works great for questioners. As an upholder, I don't really need that. I'm like, I don't need to know all the this and the that in every detail about, like, once I make up my mind, this is something I want to do, like, I can just execute on that. So I don't need to waste my time, and I don't really need accountability, which can be very burdensome to have accountability. It can take time. It can sometimes be expensive. Like if you work with a coach, you have to pay for that. Could be money very, very well spent. But if you don't need it, you don't need it.
Go through it.
And somebody said to me, I always assumed that everybody needed accountability. And then I realized I didn't. And so then I just stopped. And again, it's a way that we can get this insight into ourselves so we can build the life we want.
So guys, go and pass the test. It's on Gretchen's website. I'll put it in the show notes. And just so we talk quickly about the book, could you just tell us again? It's called The Four Tendencies.
Yes.
And available everywhere.
And it's interesting. I stumbled across this framework because in my book, Better Than Before, which is all about habit change, I was identifying the strategies that we can use to make or break our habits. And like I was just saying, some work really well for some people and not at all for others. And I was trying to understand, like, well, why is it? Why is it that some people really the strategy of identity seems to be of super importance to them? And for other people, it doesn't seem as central, or accountability seems really important to some people, but not for others. And that's what led me. So The Four Tendencies is one of the strategies in Better Than Before, one of the 21 strategies. But then when that book came out, so many people were like, I need to know more about the Four Tendencies. I was like, okay, I'll write a whole book about the Four Tendencies. Because it is fascinating to see how different we all are. You think everybody's kind of more or less seeing things the way you do.
And you wish that there's going to be, you know, a magic recipe that you can follow, but actually we're all different.
Absolutely. I think people think that it's true. Like, oh, I can get a PD. Some people will say to me, well, like, you know, tell me how to, you know, how do I change a habit? And I'm like, I have to ask you like 100 questions. It's kind of like the question, what's the best way to cook an egg? It depends on how you like to eat your eggs. There can't be a best way because it depends.
Love it. Gretchen, I'd like to go back and circle back to your journey, your personal journey. So first of all, let's talk about your childhood. Could you tell me quickly where you were raised? How was your family? And most importantly, how was it, Gretchen? Already an upholder?
Oh, yes. I was born upholder. Yes, I was quite grown up before I realized about the tendencies. But looking back, it was obvious. So I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, which is in the very middle of the United States, in a very kind of suburban place. So if you just sort of think of like classic suburbia, that's my, you know, I had one sister, two parents, one dog, you know, a tree in the front yard. And probably the thing that's most distinctive about my childhood is that I've just always loved to read, to the point where I have to like explicitly carve out, when I was young, especially, like make time for things other than reading, because, you know, it's my, and even today, you know, it's my playground and my cubicle. So it's my fun and my work is related to reading. So I spent a big, big part of my childhood reading.
Did you have any dreams when you were a child of what you would be when you'd grow older?
This is the funny thing. No. And my sister, you know, I have a podcast, Happier with Gretchen Rubin, and my sister is a co-host, and she's a television writer. She's like a really successful Hollywood showrunner, TV writer. And we talk about, like, as kids, we never thought about what we would do when we grew up. I mean, I just never thought about it, which is astonishing to me now. But somehow and she was the same way. Like we just didn't think about it. So no, I didn't have any big dreams. And part of it is, I also think when I was growing up and even sort of in college, I thought of writers as being either like novelists, poets, playwrights, or journalists, or academic writers, maybe writing a monograph about a piece of art, or the biography, you know, some academic biography of a historical figure. And none of that appealed to me. And I couldn't imagine myself doing that. So I just didn't think of myself as someone who might be a writer. So I actually went to law school and was very briefly a lawyer before I sort of realized, oh, there is a way for me to write a nonfiction book in the way that, you know, what is now called in the United States, creative nonfiction or literary nonfiction, which is things that are more, you know, kind of popular nonfiction that doesn't fall into one of those other categories of writing.
So I'd love to talk about this shift because it might have been a hell of a decision, you know, to switch from a lawyer with, you know, all that's around it to becoming a writer in nonfiction in the subject of basically happiness and like very, I mean, intangible things. So I'm sure it was a very hard decision. Could you just tell me how it happened and like walk me through like basically what went through your mind?
Well, there were aspects to it of it looking back that I think made it easier than you might think, which I'll explain. But so I was clerking on the Supreme Court for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. So in the United States, the Supreme Court is the highest court. And, you know, it's just 9 justices and the clerks who work for them. So it's a very prestigious post to have as a young lawyer. And so I was there and, you know, my eyes were wide and it was this extraordinary experience. But one day when I was walking around on my lunch hour, I asked myself sort of a rhetorical question, which I often do. I'll just say to myself, like, you know, what's the nature of happiness or whatever? And I said to myself, what am I interested in that everyone in the world is interested in? And I thought, well, power, money, fame, sex. And it was like, power, money, fame, sex. And I just became intensely fascinated and preoccupied with sort of understanding this set, which to me felt from the beginning very much like a set, like something that I needed to investigate as a set. So just for fun, I started doing a huge amount of research and note-taking, which is something that I have done ever since I was 8 years old. I will become intensely interested in something, kind of do a lot of research and kind of take notes on it. So this
while
was
familiar. We're still working as a clerk.
Yes. So this was, I was staying late after work. I was doing it on the weekends. It was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then finally it occurred to me, you know, what I am doing is the kind of thing that a person would do if they were going to write a book. And then I thought, well, maybe I could be the person to write that book. So I went out to a bookstore and got a book called something like How to Write and Sell Your Nonfiction Book Proposal. And I just followed the directions. And That was my first book was called Power, Money, Fame, Sex, A User's Guide. That's how I got an agent. And that was indeed my first book. And I think for me, what made it easier, because I have a lot of empathy for people who are struggling with trying to make a big career change, is I knew so clearly what I wanted. It wasn't even that I wanted to be a writer. It was that I wanted to write this particular book. And in fact, I had already done a lot of the work to write that particular book. And so it was less about what I didn't want than moving toward what I did want. And I think for a lot of people, and I imagine you hear this from your audience, they know what they don't want, but they don't know where they want to go. And so they have to figure that out. And I think that can take a lot of really difficult self-searching and research and sort of, you know, that can be a complicated process. So I do feel like it was easier for me and that I was being pulled towards something very specific, very forcefully. So then I was like, you know, at a certain point, I was like, well, I would rather fail as a writer than succeed as a lawyer at this point. So I need to just try to succeed. And if I fail, then I'll figure out what to do next. If I can't sell this book, but I'll just try, I'll start there and see if I can make a go of it. And then I did. And then I've been a full-time writer ever since. And of course, now I have a podcast and I have an app and I have products and I've got all this stuff, you know, that comes out of it. But it was really making that core shift to writing full-time. Yeah.
And how did it switch between this sector of interest, which is wider than happiness, it's more about like our drivers, to really focusing a lot on the subject of happiness?
You know, for me, my true subject is human nature. So that is what fascinates me. Okay. So to me, and then I wrote a biography of Winston Churchill and a biography of John F. Kennedy. And some people are like, well, those seem so out of character for your other works. But to me, they're exactly, it's all of a set. Because someone like Winston Churchill, he's such an enormous figure that he's easier to study. So you can see aspects of human nature just kind of magnified because it's all just so dramatic and we have so much information and the stakes were so high. But it's really about, well, human, you know, I learned so much about myself from studying Winston Churchill. And so all my books are about human nature. So happiness is a huge aspect of it and it kind of sweeps so much into it. But to me, everything is really about, you know, how do we understand human nature?
So I had to ask the question because you've been studying this for such a long time. What is for you maybe one of the most important insights you understood about human nature that you, I mean, for yourself, you know, that you could share with us? So really something maybe also that's underestimated by people that they don't really come across about that you really think as a pivotal, basically, insights in this area.
Well, we've already touched on it. And you said it, you know, when you said, oh, we all want the answer. I really think that, and I went into it thinking this. I mean, I fell into this trap myself thinking like, oh, all I have to do is a bunch of research and then I'll come up with a template for how to be happy. And I'll figure out a template for how to change your habits. And what I see over and over is there is no one right way. There is no one best way that each of us has to figure it out for ourselves. And you will see over and over, like in the workplace, like I'm sure you've seen all this research. Research shows that, you know, a cluttered desk means a cluttered mind and you need to get rid of everything and have it be simple and tone it all down. And then you see people being like, no, no, no. The research shows that creativity is sparked when you have piles and jumbles and a lot going on. And that's what makes people creative. And I'm like, yeah, you can show me so much research because some people like it one way and some people like it another. And some people, there's this an amazing book by Mason Curry called Daily Rituals. And he looks at just basically the daily habits of more than 100 highly successful people, you know, scientists, artists, choreographers, people of all musicians, all different forms of excellence. And you think, well, what do they have in common? Because some of them stay up late and some of them get up early and some work in a crowded studio and some work in a shack by themselves on a lake and some drink coffee and some drink vodka. And, you know, some have very calm lives so they can focus and some have tumultuous lives that spark their creativity. And so what you learn is what these people have in common is not any specific habit like get up at 6 a.m. Mm. They figure out for themselves, what do I need to do my best work? And then how do I make sure that the world gives me what I need? How do I structure my environment, my relationships, my schedule, so that I have the environment that works for me? And for some people, that means solitude. And for some people, that means company. And it's more about like understanding yourself and trying to get yourself, that, you know, it's not always 100% within our control, as we all know. You cannot control your office environment. You can't control other people. But when you know what works best for you, you can try. And sometimes, you know, like let's say you work in an office where there's a very important 8 a.m. staff meeting every day. Very, very important. Like, and you look around and you're like, you know what? I worked with these people. These people are night people. They don't really wake up till like 10:30, 11 in the morning. Why do we have these meetings at 8 a.m.? So now maybe you can go to your boss and say, like, I think we'd have a lot more energy out of this team if we could move it later in the day. And maybe you can't move it later in the day, but you can try, you can think about it. Sometimes people are like, one thing you hear all the time about exercise is you should get up and do it first thing in the morning. And there's a million reasons why that makes sense. But if you're a night person, that's just not realistic. You're much more likely to exercise later in the day when you have more energy. And so again, don't, when somebody's like, well, the right way to do it is to do it first thing in the morning, you got to say to yourself, well, it could be true, but it's not necessarily true. And I have to think about what's true for me. When have I succeeded in the past? You know, what feels right to me? What feels appealing to me? Because a lot of times we kind of try to jam ourselves into somebody else's model.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't work.
It feels so just, you know, and so true.
That's a lot of us, right? You're like, because you just think about the people in your life and you're like, obviously that's true. Obviously, the same setup doesn't work for everybody, or we would have all figured it out. No. So it does seem obvious. And yet I do feel like for a lot of people, it's a big revelation to realize.
Yeah, also, it's a revelation, but it seems like it's a risk, or it can be scary, actually, because, you know, if you're an obliger, for instance, I guess it's more difficult not to think about what others are going to expect. And so returning on, you know, like thinking about yourself and being self-aware of who you are is probably not as easy maybe as for a rebel or for, I don't know, maybe I'm saying something wrong. But anyway, yeah. I think it feels yes. like in our culture, or at least in France, I don't know the US, but it's difficult sometimes to be so focused on yourself. And people yes. have a lot of, let's say, fears kind of about, yeah.
Absolutely. No, we see that in the United States as well. I think it can be, it can seem selfish. Yeah. It can seem very self-focused, especially if you think, well, I should be more focused on others. But in fact, you know, when you understand yourself, then you really can set yourself up for to achieve your aims. And so self-regard is not selfish. It's mm-hmm. sort of a necessary part of it. And one thing also, you know, kind of related to what you're saying, is sometimes people say to me like, well, in a world so full of suffering and injustice, isn't it really selfish for me to be thinking about my own happiness? But in fact, what research shows, and I think if you think about the people in your own life, you see this, that happier people tend to be more interested in the problems of other people and more mm-hmm. interested in the problems of the world. They donate more money, they volunteer more time, they're more likely to vote, they have healthier habits, they have more kind of tolerance and sense of humor. You know, when we're unhappy, it's very easy to become isolated and defensive and preoccupied yeah. with our own problems because we're not happy. And being happier, then we can really turn outward. And I think, yeah. you know, at times when there is a lot of suffering and injustice of the world, it can be tempting to just shut it off and say, like, I can't bear it. When I think happier people have a greater capacity to open themselves up and to think about the problems of the world and to try to help rather than to say, like, I feel so overwhelmed by what's going on with me. I just can't bear it. I can't look because it's too much. Now, that's not necessarily always true, but I do think that this, it is just not true that happier people, you know, are necessarily selfish. I mean, there's kind of this idea, like, if you're happy, you just want to, like, drink, you know, drink and eat by the beach. But in fact, happier people are like, yeah. can't we come up with a better way to distribute malaria nets? You know, let's do something about that. You know, it actually makes people want to turn outward. So it isn't selfish.
Super, super meaningful. I'd like to do a complete segue, so I hope you won't mind. But to switch a little and speak about your own entrepreneurial journey, because as I told you, this podcast is also a lot about business and entrepreneurship. And I guess it's also something we talk a little bit less about. But it seems from, I mean, we don't know each other that well, that you're a super creative person, the podcast, the books, everything, the app. And often I've seen that creative people struggle to scale their business because they're the key ingredient that makes the magic. You know, they're the one that are the creative people, and all the more so in your case because you're also a brand, basically. And so, I mean, I've seen and observed that you've been able to create a whole ecosystem around Gretchen Rubin, The Happiest Project, everything, your own personal brand. And so I really wanted to know first first, when did you decide that it was not going to be just about a book, but it was going to be more than that? And it was going to be about knowing the human nature and talking about it and helping people. So something much larger than just being a writer.
Well, I was very fortunate because as I started writing about happiness, like tools became more and more available to people who are not technical. So I started a blog writing about happiness when blogs were really big and really, you know, used that and was very excited about that way that that allowed me to connect with an audience. And then like I was approached several years later, oh, do you want to have a podcast? And I was like, yeah, my sister and I have always wanted to have a radio show. This is even better. So then I had a podcast, and that was just when podcasting was sort of really starting to be something that a lot of people were getting into. And so, you know, the kind of the barriers to entry were falling. So yeah. I took advantage of it. But I do have to say that for years, I mean, 4 years, I really, you know, I have to admit that I knew that I needed help. I had like one person who sort of helped me here and there. But I was like, I know that I'm being held back by my inability to delegate, my inability to like get up to speed on things that I don't know about and don't have time to learn about and don't have the expertise for. And I just sort of spun my wheels. Like I knew that I needed that. And I just sort of didn't know how to go about it. And one of my favorite aphorisms is when the teacher is ready, the student appears. And I don't know what changed, but finally I was like, hey, there's this one guy that I kind of am analogous to. And I could say to him, how did you hire a team? And then I just did what he told me. He was like, I talked to this woman, and I'm like, I'm going to color myself. He's like, I read this book. And I'm like, I'm reading that book. I just decided I can't, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. If it worked for this guy, it's going to work for me. And that doing that allowed me to hire my first person, Anne Mercogliano, who's now my CEO. And having that person, then she had a vision of like how this could be created, because I'm a writer. And before that, I was a lawyer. I had no way of knowing what were the titles of the people that we needed. I didn't even know. I'm like, what are even the roles? Like, it felt so vague and kind of impossible to me. But then what I found is like, just identify the problem, you know, and now I say this to myself over and over, identify the problem. The problem is like, I don't know how a person hires. I don't know how you hire, and I don't know how to describe what I need. And so finally I said to somebody, I don't know how to hire, and I don't know how to describe what I need. Can you help? You know, identify the problem, ask for help. And then it was just like bit by bit, I was able to do it. But I really look back and I think I wasted a lot of time, because instead of sort of sitting down and really thinking through it, I just kind of hoped that the universe would throw somebody in my path. I knew people for whom that had happened. And I thought, ooh, well, maybe that'll just happen to me. And this problem will magically fix itself, which happens occasionally, which is very confusing, but it did not happen in my case. And I wish I had been more purposeful earlier. But, you know, they say the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago, and the second best time is now. And, you know, the time came when I did do it, and I'm very glad that I did. And so now it's all, you know, it's very well underway.
What I find very inspiring is that, you know, a lot of creative people have ideas and can launch a business, but again, the scaling is more difficult, but they don't accept the fact that they're not going to be the one who's going to push everywhere, and that they need help, and that they need to hire. And I find so inspiring that someone so successful as you, you know, knows that you're not perfect everywhere. You don't know everything about business. Yeah. And so you also need help. And that I find is very interesting.
Well, and also what's even more terrifying is that you don't know what you don't know. So you might, I knew there were certain things I didn't know, but then there was a whole bunch of things that I didn't know. And they were also very important. So I was like, oh heck, I'm in worse shape than I thought.
We always are.
And so I think you're right. It's like if something's important, it's like there's a lot of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of excitement that comes from collaboration. I 100% know as a writerly person, you know, I control every little single word, but there are other things that I do not need to control. You know, a lot of times there's no wrong choice. It's like, you know, should we do this or should we do that? It's like, I don't have to spend a week noodling that over. If somebody smart who I trust is like, I think option A is the way to go. If I don't have a strong view the other way, like, okay. You know what? I just save myself.
Sorry, I interrupted. Yeah. But sometimes it seems it's also a lot about ego, because a lot of people don't want to let go because they feel that they're failing if they're not doing it themselves. So
100%. I actually know somebody who's going through this right now, where he's created a business where it's just the classic problem where he's such a bottleneck. Because he won't delegate decisions to others. And yet then he's very frustrated that nothing moves forward, but he doesn't really know enough to have good judgment, which he sort of knows. So then he thinks he needs to get educated enough to have the capacity to make the right call. Well, nothing can happen, because everything means that he's basically got to have 5 full-time jobs. But it is to relinquish that control and that responsibility. It is hard.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations, because you've done it brilliantly. So now, Gretchen, to end the interview, because I want to be respectful of your time, I always have a few one-on-one questions that I like to ask. So the first one is about a great failure that you've lived, if you could elaborate on it, and most importantly, the lesson that really was important for you through this failure.
Well, this ties perfectly to what we were just saying. So one of the great failures in my life is I wrote a book called 40 Ways to Look at JFK, and it was a big flop. And in publishing, when your book doesn't sell, they tell you it didn't find its audience. Mm. So I would say that book did not find its audience. But what was really important about that is I felt so powerless. I was like, there are all these people who I know that I think would really be interested in this book, but I have no way to tell them about it. If I can't, if newspapers aren't writing about it, if radio and TV isn't doing interviews of me, if a bookstore isn't putting it out on the shelf, I have no way of telling people about it. And that's what really got me to start a blog, because I thought, I want to have my own way of reaching people who I know are interested in the same subjects that I'm interested in. I know all these people are interested in JFK, but I can't tell them about my interest in it. And so when my next book was Happiness, I was determined. I'm like, I want to forge a direct relationship with people who are interested in my subject. Mm-hmm. And that has just, from that time on, a huge part of what I do is, how do I connect with an audience who's interested in the same subjects as I am? And I'm even more fortunate, because for me, it's like the world is my research assistant, and people send me so many like links and resources and books and examples, that it so deepens my understanding of my subject, because I have this direct connection. But if that book had done even kind of well, I probably never would have been led to do that, because I would have thought, oh, well, this works for me. Don't fix it if it's not broken. And I don't know that I would have done all the things that I've gone on to do that I find to be so rewarding.
So a blessing in disguise. That's crazy.
Absolutely. Blessing in disguise.
But they're more often than we know.
They are.
If you could change anything in your personal or professional life, in your, journey, what would you do differently?
I think I would have hired a team earlier. I would have made that shift earlier. I love the team I have, so I wouldn't want a different team. I would have wanted to have this team earlier.
Super. Is there a maxim, a quote, words of wisdom that means something to you, maybe that you also repeat to yourself or have somewhere written in your home that you could share with us?
Oh, I mean, thousands. I'm literally working on a book of aphorisms, which are aphorisms that I have written. And then I also collect aphorisms that other people have written. And I also collect proverbs of the professions. So I have hundreds, thousands of these. But the one that's the most important to me that I say to myself all the time, which I wrote too, is we can accept ourselves and expect more from ourselves. So we can understand our own nature and kind of respect the natural limitations of our character, but we can also push ourselves to grow and push ourselves out of our comfort zone. So I think sometimes people think you have to choose, but we can accept ourselves and expect more from ourselves. Mm.
Very, very interesting. This discrepancy is exactly what I had in mind when I asked this prior question. So thank you for sharing this. I have also a non-politically correct question, if I can put it this way. It's basically, be careful. If there's something you believe that is usually not, like, let's say a shared belief, for instance, I had a guest on my podcast who said that older people are actually not wiser because they have a lot of cognitive biases. So something, basically, that is not a shared belief that you believe.
I believe that an area that's very understudied and yet is the effect of children on parents, because we do a lot of research on how parents affect their children. But I think that children have a lot of effect on their parents. And I think that easy children make good parents. And so a lot of times people who pat themselves on the back for their excellent parenting and take responsibility for the way their children are actually responding to those children. I think there's a lot of like upstream effects. And I think that is not studied. And I mean, you see a little bit about it because there's a little bit of research on how children's temperament can affect mothers returning to the workplace. And that's obviously kind of a good example of this. But I think there's a lot that we could learn from. I'm a big believer in the genetic roots of personality. I think we're hardwired with a lot of things. We bring those into the world and they affect our families. And I would be really fascinated to know more about how that influence is felt.
Maybe a next book, and I'll be happy to talk about it on the podcast.
Good, maybe. There you go.
Two last questions. Is there a subject on which you've changed your mind?
Oh, well, I used to think with happiness, I used to think, like, I love novelty and familiarity. I love repetition. Like, for my Five Senses book, one of the things that I did was go to the Metropolitan Museum every day for a year, because I wanted to see what it would be like to go there every day. And I've basically gone there every day ever since, because I just love it so much. So I love repetition. And so there's the happiness research is very clear that novelty and challenge tend to make people happier, even for things as minor is like going to a new restaurant tends to make people happier. So I thought, oh, well, that's not for me. Like, that might be true for most people, but I love repetition, familiarity, mastery. And then when I did the research and tested it out on myself, I found out, oh, you know what? novelty and challenge make me happier too. I am not the exception. I love familiarity and mastery, but I also thrive and get great benefits from novelty and challenge. So I went in there thinking, oh, I 100% know myself and how this affects me. And I completely changed my mind.
I love this example. Last question. Is there a book that has had a great impact on you that maybe even changed your thinking that you could share with us? It can be anything, literature, entrepreneurship, whatever.
A million books have changed my thinking. I'm very subject to epiphany. The list of books that have blown my mind is like 1,000 long. But if there's one book that I think really changed the way I saw the world in a very concrete way and is the book that I most often give as gifts, it's a book called A Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander. And what he does is he looks for patterns in like design of towns, design of offices, and most designs of homes that kind of satisfy us in this kind of deep human way. So it's not like, oh, this is Baroque style, or, oh, you should have 6 chairs around your dining room table. It's things like staircase as stage, windows overlooking life, secret place, child cave, sleeping to the east, half wild garden, and cascade of roofs. And then with pictures, he'll show how there can be a 14th century Buddhist temple and a 19th century English manor and a 21st century Florida house, how they all have cascade of roofs. And you're like, I love a cascade of roofs. And it completely changed the way I see environments. Like, he has a thing about ceilings at different heights. Look around. When you're in a place that feels good, look at the ceilings, and you probably will see there are ceilings at different heights. There's something about, or windows on 2 sides. A room feels much more full of life if it has windows on 2 sides. And so it just changed the way that I perceive my environment in just a very profound way.
Great. Thank you. I have not read it, so I'm of course going to do it. And most importantly, I'm going to put it in the show notes for our
audience. Good. Well, if anybody reads it and like, tell me what you think. It's a book that you can kind of flip through. You don't have to read it from beginning to end. You can pick and choose what catches your interest.
Well, Gretchen, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing all these very precious insights. If the audience wants to know more about you, they can follow you, of course, on Instagram, on LinkedIn. They can go also on your website. Is that probably the best way to follow up, I guess?
Yes, GretchenRubin.com. And you'll get links to everything. The podcast is called Happier with Gretchen Rubin, if you're like in your podcast player. But yeah, everything, you can get to everything through GretchenRubin.com.
And I highly recommend the podcast, by the way, because there's 3 different formats. And so it's very, it changes a lot. You're never accustomed to it. And so it's always very lively and interesting.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, thank you, Gretchen. I'll put everything in the show notes. And I hope to see you soon. Best of luck for the launch of Life in 5 Senses. And see you soon in France, I hope.
Yeah, well, I hope so. Well, thank you so much. I so enjoyed our conversation. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye bye les amis, c'est la fin de cet épisode, mais avant de vous quitter, quelques détails en plus. D'abord, pour toutes les infos sur le podcast et cet épisode, ça se passe sur polinegno.com, vous aurez tout promis, juré. Aussi, si vous souhaitez me contacter pour me poser des questions ou me proposer de nouveaux invités, eh bien n'hésitez pas à le faire directement sur LinkedIn, Instagram ou YouTube, je vous attends. Enfin, encore 1000 merci de m'avoir écouté jusqu'ici, j'espère de tout cœur que ça vous a plu et je vous dis à très vite pour un nouvel épisode.